this is Sina.
Welcome to the oral argument session of the Nevada Court of Appeals here in the Supreme Court's courtroom. And our first case this morning is Sidney Stafford and Pulte Building Systems versus Rebecca Magruder. I'm joined today by Judge Abby Sober here on my right and Judge Jerome Tao here on my left. We're very happy to see all of you. We really enjoy doing oral arguments. And who will be arguing for the appellant?
Howard Carlson on behalf of the appellant.
Right. And who's with you, Mr. Carlson?
Jason Williams and Ross.
All right, Mr. Williams, welcome too. Okay. All right, Mr. Carlson, you can go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Court. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for the moment. And this appeal involves a jury trial that was resolved in favor of the defendants, and after which the trial judge determined that a new trial was necessary based for the most part on a conclusion that a expert witness called by the plaintiff had so infected the process so as to create an irregularity in the proceedings under the MRCP 59A1. Mr. Keenan is the subject of that ruling by the trial court, and Mr. Keenan was a designated expert by my clients. Mr. Keenan was the subject of a motion in limine, part of an omnibus motion in limine filed by the plaintiff, wherein the argument was made that Mr. Keenan's testimony would not there would be insufficient evidence to lay a proper foundation under the decision of the Nevada Supreme Court regarding Hallmark. The trial court, having considered that, decided that if a sufficient foundation was laid, that the witness would be allowed to testify. He then issued subsequently a written order basically saying that the motion to exclude Mr. Keenan was denied. As the court is aware, motions in limine are interlocutory in nature and can be revisited at any time during the trial based upon the evidence that's adduced during the trial. In this case, I think the court is presented, and we are presented, with a unique situation in that the motion is denied to exclude our expert, and then the plaintiff chose to call that expert in the case in chief. They also stipulated to his qualifications. They also offered testimony directly relevant to the issue that they then complained about during the motion from the trial. They asked Mr. Cannon to describe what he did in the investigation. They asked Mr. Cannon to describe the method of the accident. They asked Mr. Cannon to describe how the accident took place and the results. All of that testimony was elicited by the plaintiff without objection. And I briefly point out to the court and invite the consideration that, in fact, introduction of evidence yourself is not something you get to complain about on appeal or in the motion for a new trial.
Well, why shouldn't this court follow the Nevada Supreme Court reasoning in the Pineda case? Because like Pineda, Magruder's counsel was only attempting to introduce and downplay potentially harmful character evidence prior to its admission by an adverse party. So isn't, whether criminal or civil, isn't evidence evidence? And this is character evidence and its admission.
I was just about to address the Pineda case, and I would respectfully disagree with the court that it was character evidence. It was direct evidence about the events of the accident versus the characters or proposition or type of evidence such as was in Pineda. Pineda was an interesting case, and the U.S. Supreme Court didn't follow the United States Supreme Court in that regard, saying that if character evidence was going to come in anyway, then you can, in fact, diffuse it. In this case, I think a big distinction between Pineda and our case is that this motion really denied by the trial court did not admit the evidence. What it did was say, if the evidence can be sufficient foundation can be laid, then the evidence can come in. That, to me, invites the fact that there has to be a subsequent objection to the testimony, because the court didn't realize they did in Pineda, which was basically, if he testifies, the prior convictions come in. In this case, the court said, if you can lay a foundation, then evidence comes in. Ours was conditional.
Well, but hang on, but every motion in limine is subject to being connected to trial. Just because I make a judge makes a pretrial motion granting, you know, some evidence coming in, it doesn't mean it automatically comes in. You still have to have a foundation. It has to come in through non-hearsay. It has to be authenticated. It doesn't mean that you skip over every other step of introducing it. Now, the other reason in Pineda, it's a criminal case, which is why, you know, this question of does a criminal case carry over. A prior conviction doesn't have to be authenticated. It's a certified copy of a public record. But you don't have a lot of that in civil cases, and that's one of the questions that we're going to have here is how much does Pineda carry over because it's a criminal case. But in the civil world, okay, you don't have things like, you literally have things like criminal convictions which are automatic, and you just show them to the jury and become ready, and you don't have to have a sponsoring witness. But the idea here is every motion in limine, just because I say, yes, this witness can testify to that, this doesn't mean he just gets to break every other rule of evidence, right? Every motion in limine is subject to the rules of, the other rules of evidence.
I certainly agree with the court on that, and I think that's an important aspect of this particular motion, or this particular appeal, because the requirement of contemporaneous objections to the testimony was not met by the plaintiff. If they're going to object to a foundation, if they're going to object to the evidence, if they're going to object to whether he, in fact, assists the trier of fact, they have to make an objection. And what I was hoping to put out to the court was that the motion in limine didn't satisfy that contemporaneous objection part, because although it did make a motion in limine, it was not, it was, the judge points out there is, in fact, an obligation to that motion was not, this evidence is in. That motion is if a proper foundation is laid, then the evidence can come in. So it was incumbent upon the plaintiff to object if they felt that the evidence, the foundation, was not there. They didn't do that.
They didn't do that. Well, I mean, there's different kinds of motions in limine. You know, if a party thinks, I mean, otherwise expert, is totally unqualified, okay? And you file a motion in limine saying, look, this guy shouldn't testify because there isn't a hallmark. That doesn't mean that you're conceding every other objection, right? The objection you made is this guy shouldn't come in at all. But I can also concede that if he had met the requirements of hallmark, if he, you know, that he's probably going to get up there and say, these are, you know, I have, you know, personal knowledge and all the other stuff, right? But that doesn't mean that you're waiving the objection to the fact that he should testify at all, just because you're conceding other elements that you would have to establish in order for him to testify.
I couldn't agree more, but that then leads to the conclusion that there has to be an objection to the evidence when it's proper.
So that's the question I think he's getting to, and he raised it. Does there have to be another objection during the trial as the foundation is being laid or in that order process?
Well, I believe it does, because in this case, in Pineda, it was if he testifies, the convictions come in. In this case, it was if you lay a proper foundation, then the testimony may come in, subject, as the court said, to all the objections. They never made any of those objections. They never objected to the foundation. In fact, they put the witness on thereby waiving the objections to the foundation of his testimony. They put the testimony in front of the jury. And then they want us to speculate that the part we put on is what convinced the jury to go in our favor versus the part they put on. And so they're asking this court, and I think the trial court, to speculate completely about which evidence put on through this witness without objection was the catalyst to the verdict in this case. And I don't think the trial court or this court, or certainly not the parties, can determine which part of that evidence was the determining factor, if any of it, in this verdict, which was in our favor after a complete.
Well, but the trial judge seemed to think it was pretty important. I mean, what role did Mr. Cannon play in the ultimate outcome? Can you tell it all? You said we would be speculating, but the judge Smith said there was only one witness on this point.
Well, there was the completely opposite testimony of both the plaintiff and the defendant, drivers, that about the turn signals. There was complete opposite testimony about whether she sped up to pass on the right side trying to make the turn. There was conflicting evidence between the people who were there as to what happened. One of the non-conflicting parts was she testified, I was behind the vehicle for quite a while. At the time of approaching the intersection, I was at least two car lengths back. I was traveling 28 miles per hour. And at that time, I think his turn signal was on the left. He says my turn signal was on the right. There was no argument that there's any way to turn left at this intersection. There's a blank wall on the other side of the street. The testimony from the plaintiff was that I'd seen other trucks parked in the middle there waiting to go to our side, but there wasn't any support for that from the plaintiff, from the defendant. So basically he said, I got up there, I made turn the city line, it's a city road, and I made my turn. She cut me inside trying to beat my turn around there.
And what the jury, with the jury finding a 55-45 split on comparative negligence, doesn't that mean it's a pretty close question?
It is, but I think, having been there, I would be hard-pressed to say which of the testimony was what put the jury over on that. Mr. Cannon's testimony could have been that, or it could have been that they wouldn't believe the plaintiff about the right turn signal or the left turn signal.
Well, if you're saying it could have gone either way, and the problem here is we have a standard review, which is the district court did what it did, and you looked at it through the lens of abuse of discretion. So if you're conceding that, yeah, it was a close call, it could have gone either way, maybe it was important, maybe it wasn't, then by definition, that's within the district court's discretion, isn't it?
I would disagree with that. I would say it's close call either way on the motion for a trial. The jury selection, we're trying to determine what the jury relied upon. We, I think I'm out here, can't say I know what the jury relied on. They didn't come out and say it, there are no declarations, there's no record saying what they relied upon. But the trial court had made a determination that allowing the plaintiff to call a witness, and that we are then punished for that calling of the witness because they decided to put him on, they did not object to any of our testimony, and the contemporaneous objection, I think, prevents them from not coming to you and saying, we should have rejected all that, we shouldn't have put him on, but hey, the trial judge say this and you should uphold that because, frankly, the jury had all the evidence of them, they put it on, they didn't object to ours. As a result of that, I think we...
Well, what about this? In BMW versus Roth, which is a 2011 Supreme Court case, they actually held that where the admission or exclusion of evidence at trial is in harmony with the order in limine, the alleged error at trial is the same as the error alleged in the ruling on the motion. Therefore, because there's no new error, the motion in limine properly preserves the error claim without a contemporaneous objection at trial. And so the idea the argument they're making here is, look, we made an objection, it was denied, we think it's wrong, but now the trial has been shaped. So the idea of calling your witness, the one we didn't want to be in at all, is we're going to try to take the sting out of their testimony. We're just dealing with the trial the way the district court has framed it, even though we disagree with the district court. We've made an objection, objection is preserved, we're still going to raise objection on appeal, but we're trying to deal with the trial as it is.
I'd like to quote, to consider the fact that the ruling from the motion really wasn't that the evidence was admissible or coming in. It was if a proper foundation could be made.
Well, the ruling is not that the evidence is out. What they wanted is the evidence is out, and the district just denied that.
And I believe if evidence is conditional upon certain facts taking place, then it's incumbent upon them to object in a timely fashion, which they chose not to do. And it's beyond my reserve time, but Padilla, as it turned out, is a criminal case and talks about very clear constitutional issues. This does not raise it. And I don't think that this was the same kind of evidence, but it is interesting that there was a felony conviction in this case introduced. But on that, the issue, I think, for this court is, was all right, that occurred, was the labor intention by the plaintiffs in the trial strategy, and I believe it was, and came in not complaining about evidence that they introduced in front of the jury, and asking this court and the trial court to speculate about that that was the reason that the Delaware verdict occurred between the plaintiff and the defendant. And I've got about 2 minutes left in any rations.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. We'll wait for rebuttal.
Okay, please the court, Judge Gibbons, Judge Silver, Judge Tao. I think the things that were addressed in the initial arguments are right on point. But the first factual issue that I'd like to clear up is this idea that Judge Smith's order was that the testimony was only coming in if the foundation could be laid. That's what he said in the oral commentary during the hearing. And as we know from our Supreme Court and West versus Clark County School District and Department of Family Services versus 8th Judicial District Court, a written order is all that matters. Oral commentary by the court, and this is coming from those two cases, it's ineffective for any purpose. So when we're looking at the analysis in this case, we have to look at the written order. And what the written order from Judge Smith said, and this is in the Joint Appendix, Volume 1, page 57, is that plaintiff's motion limiting number 39, motion strike defendant's accident reconstruction, biomechanical experts Karen Knapp and Mark Cannon is denied. If he wanted to make it conditional on other things, such as laying the foundation, he could have done so, and he did so with 10 other motions in this order that he drafted. So I think that's the basis where we need to kind of shift from the way that the defense or the appellants are trying to frame this, is that the order is what it is in the
order. Doesn't it use the word foundation in the order?
He does, in 10 other orders. The one right above it, he says, it's motion limit number 38. He says, if the information is relevant and foundation can be laid, the court will revisit the issue during trial. The one right above that, if the information is relevant, foundation can be laid, the court will revisit the issue during trial.
It doesn't use foundation at all in reference to the expert.
No, motion limit number 39, and it's on Joint Appendix, Volume 1, page 57. And that's an order written by Judge Smith. It's not something that was drafted by either of the parties, and he signed. It was written by Judge Smith. So I think that's the first kind of just factual problem we need to get rid of when we're looking at this analysis.
Let me ask you this. Why would Panetta apply in this case? Because in Panetta, you actually stipulate at trial to the qualifications of the expert or expert candidate before the jury. Would that not amount to waiver then of your objection and appeals?
No, I think there's two issues. Under Hallmark, there's three requirements that need to be met. There's the qualification, the assistance requirement, and then within the scope of the expert, the field of expertise. And so stipulating to qualification doesn't mean then you just get to testify. You still have to meet those other two requirements. So we did stipulate, Mr. Cannon has the qualifications to be an accident reconstructionist, but we don't stipulate to this assistance requirement. So we didn't waive it by stipulating to his qualifications. But I do think that Panetta should apply in the civil context because the policy arguments and the principles are the same. Everyone is entitled to a fair trial, right? Whether it's criminal or civil setting, everyone's entitled to a fair trial. And I think Judge Silver, you hit it right on the head, but this was character evidence that they were seeking to admit because again, I think we need to just clarify the record a little bit. Mr. Stafford testified that he did not see my client until he had completed his term and she was up on the curb. He has no testimony about what she was doing before he saw her and the accident had already happened. The only testimony disputing what Ms. Magruder's account of the accident is Mr. Cannon. Mr. Cannon, who says, no, she should have been able to stop, the force of the impact wouldn't have pushed her up on the curb. He's the only person who can dispute what happened from the time that the vehicles were, you know, started their path until Mr. Stafford saw her after the accident. So they're offering this evidence to say, don't believe anything Ms. Magruder says about the accident, she's wrong. And so I think that we're talking about the same type of evidence and we're talking about the same boundaries that civil attorneys are put in, the same as the attorneys in Panetta. When you know the adverse testimony is going to come in, and you've got to try to minimize it as much as you can. And the reason that we actually called Mr. Cannon in this case was because we were on a break in between witnesses. We anticipated Ms. Magruder would be our next witness, and we noticed that Mr. Cannon was in the courtroom. We asked Judge Smith to invoke the exclusionary.
I think the argument that he's making today is, okay, there are situations where, as a preemptive strike, you know, knowing the judge has made a ruling and this witness is coming in anyway, you call the witness and just sort of, you know, what I used before with him is you try to take the sting out of testimony. What he is suggesting happened here is, yeah, you did a little of that, but you also established affirmative stuff through him. And so why isn't that part of it a waiver?
Well, our position is not just that the testimony that came in, when defense put him up in their case in chief, we're saying that all of his testimony was prejudicial and should not have been allowed. But we relied on Judge Smith's order, and I think we were right in doing so. We didn't need to re-raise the objection. There's a pretty clear history of that. It starts with the Ninth Circuit in Smith versus Ross. Richmond versus State is when the Nevada Supreme Court adopted it here in Nevada. And then most recently in the BMW versus Roth case is that if you have a definitive order, the party can rely on that order, and that preserves the objection. So we relied on Judge Smith's written order. We tried to take the sting out of it, just like Pineda says that attorneys, you know, can and should do, even though that's in the criminal context. And we proceeded with the case.
Why not raise the objection again? So you're about to explain that Ms. McGrida was not ready, Mr. Cannon was there. I think you were going to say you were filling out some time.
No. So thank you for letting me clarify that. Ms. McGrida, we were prepared to have her testify. She was there in the courtroom with us. We noticed Mr. Cannon was in the courtroom. We asked Judge Smith to invoke the exclusionary rule so that he can't now sit in and fill in the gaps in his testimony. We believe the foundation for his opinions is so factually deficient that we can't get the jury to hear him at all.
You're preempting him from sitting there listening before you can stick him in the stand, make him testify first. He's stuck and letting you never heard her testify.
Exactly.
But did the judge deny that request to exclude him?
He did. So we were faced with, do we let our client testify and then maybe he can bolster his foundation by hearing her testimony, or do we just put him up and get the record straight of what he knows before he hears her testimony?
So how about at the conclusion of his testimony after the plaintiff calls him to renew your motion and eliminate, but now it's in the trial context. You tell the judge you ruled on what you saw before, but now you actually have the witness in front of you. You heard firsthand, you can see how poor this is. This should be excluded.
Yeah, absolutely. In hindsight, you know, could we have done that? Absolutely. But I think, again,
or after the defense calls him, or at the end of the trial before you close. In other words, the judge after the trial came to this conclusion, so there was a progression in his mind, I'm sure, of how he thought this was playing out, and it changed.
Yeah, absolutely. And if I could rewind the clock 2 years, I'd do that. But I think there's a pretty clear and strong record that we're not required to do that. Could we have done it? Should we have done it? Would I not be here? Probably.
But you have to do it.
BMW versus Roth says that if you have a conclusive order from the court, that is enough to preserve your objection. You don't need to re-raise the objection. And part of, and I think it was in Richmond versus State, part of the appellant's argument in that case for why it should preserve your objection is so that, you know, orders have, you know, meaning that the parties can rely on the court's pretrial orders. But I think more importantly, as a trial attorney, is that so we're not required to get up with every motion when we raise your objection, and then the jury's wondering, what are you doing? Why are you trying to, are you trying to keep out evidence and then potentially, you know, prejudice you in front of the jury? That's why we do pretrial motions in limine, to consolidate the issues so that people know what evidence is coming in, what's not coming in, and so that we don't have to raise all of the objections again in front of the jury. And that's something that, as you know, as a trial attorney, I think is very important, so that it doesn't look like you're trying to hide something. So, again, should we have done it? Yes, and I wouldn't be here. But did we were required to do it? No. And there's Ninth Circuit case law and case law from our Supreme Court that says we did not have to do it. Our objection is preserved from the motion in limine. The other issue that I wanted to bring up that didn't get raised in the initial arguments was that of the range of vision jury instruction. And that wasn't part of the order for new trial, but if and when this case is retried, you know, I think it's important that we have instruction about what are the proper jury instructions that need to be presented to the jury. In our case, the testimony was that, yes, Ms. McGruder saw Mr. Stafford's tractor trailer, you know, as they're going a few blocks down the road, and that suddenly and without warning, he made what he called a fish hook turn, which is he turned to the left and then turned right in front of her, and that she slammed on the brakes, honked the horn, and there was nothing she could do. Now, the range of vision instruction that was given over our objection at trial was that a motorist has a duty to avoid a collision with any vehicle within his or her range of vision. I'm paraphrasing, but it's part of the it's part of the record. And the last time that our Supreme Court visited this jury instruction was in 1962, and it was a case where the defendant was driving at night, saw a car ahead with lights about a mile away, and then a quarter mile realized that car was stopped and made no attempt to avoid the collision. And this is a totally different factual case. But in reaching that conclusion in the Rocky Mountain versus Johnson case, the Supreme Court said, we find no reason to change this rule based on the facts of this case, right? A case where you're at night, you make no attempt to avoid.
But if it's different, you can certainly argue to the jury, and if it's still good law, despite it being 1962, you can still argue to the jury that, you know, this is what that instruction means, you know. For example, at night, you're to avoid. I mean, you can still distinguish it to the jury without precluding that particular instruction.
Yeah, I don't disagree, but the instruction in the Rocky Mountain case was, and again, I'm paraphrasing, so I'm the case right here, but has a duty to avoid hazards that are illuminated, driving at night can be illuminated in his headlights. Now, this instruction was just a blanket, that you have a duty to drive in such a way that you can stop in time to avoid collision with an object within your range of vision. Now, if that is the law, and that's what we're telling juries, then every near-end car accident is negligence per se. And we know that that's not true. We know it's not true. There's a Nevada Supreme Court case, Nels versus Leonard, it's a 1981 case, that says that inability to avoid collision is not automatic liability. And the way that jury instruction number 22 in our case, the range of vision instruction, was presented, this blanket instruction that appears to obviate or negate, you know, our Supreme Court's holding that just because you can't stop doesn't mean you're automatically
moved. Procedurally, okay, this is an appeal from an order in a new trial. You're the prevailing party here.
You didn't cross-appeal this issue.
Right, so I'm not sure you can actually decide, because you're the winner here as you stand here right now, and you're asking us, and you're right, it wasn't one of the grounds in the district judge's order for a new trial. So this is an issue that you think went against you at trial, but you're the winner right now, and you didn't file a cross-appeal, so how is it that you can even reach that issue?
It was part of the motion for a new trial. Judge Smith just determined that it was moot and didn't include it in his order. Whether or not it's right for your decision, we wanted to bring it to the court's attention just because, you know, if it does get retried.
Correct. Presumably he's going to do it again because he did it the first
time. You didn't cross appeal though, is that correct?
We did not.
Okay.
So just
the other side doesn't have a chance to even respond to what you're saying right now.
They did in their reply brief. They did address it.
I'm talking about their appellate brief.
Yes, I apologize. But I just want to remind the court, I think it's came up a few times in the initial discussion, that the standard upon which this court needs to base its decision is abuse of discretion. And in order to find that Judge Smith abused his discretion, you have to find that he based his decision on an erroneous set of facts, or that he misapplied the law, and neither are true in this case. If you look at his order sets forth and it relies upon trial testimony of Mark Cannon. So there's no erroneous set of facts. It's straight from the trial transcript. And there's no misapplication of the law. He cites the Hallmark standards and why Mr. Cannon didn't meet those. And I didn't point this out earlier, but I think it's the biggest thing in the case that is void from the initial brief is that he did not meet the assistance requirement. The things that he did not know are almost identical to the things that the expert in Hallmark did not know, and the court in that case found that allowing him to testify prejudiced the plaintiff and prevented her from having a fair trial. So this whole thing is about whether or not Mr. Cannon had a basis for his opinions, and that's what they haven't even talked about. You know, Mr. Cannon didn't know the speed of either vehicle at the time of impact, the initial area of impact where the initial area of contact occurred. He didn't inspect her vehicles or test her brakes to determine if she could stop as fast as he said she could. He didn't know the distances they traveled. He didn't know the positions of the vehicle before they crashed. He didn't know where she was when she saw him turning, even though he's going to say she had enough time to stop and prevent the accident. He relied on photographs of the damage, and he didn't calculate the coefficient of friction. Another important thing, if you're going to say someone had enough time to break and avoid an accident.
I'm sorry, did you depose that expert prior to the trial as well?
We did.
Just make sure.
We deposed him, and based on that deposition and his
motion,
that was our motion in limine. Thank you.
Ms. Fischer, thank you.
Thank you. This is the difference of opinion about whether the motion is clear and specific.
Let me respond to this, because I've got the district court's order regarding the plaintiff's unrest motions in limine from me right now. There's rulings on 40 motions in limine. Some of them, I didn't count, but it looks like maybe somewhere between a quarter and a half of them have a sentence that the motion is conditionally granted if the information is relevant and foundation can be laid. The court will revisit the issue during trial. The court may revisit this issue depending on what the evidence is presented at trial. But on number 39, which is what this one is, that language is not there. So what's your response to, it seems like that, because he's got it in other sentences, isn't that an intentional omission?
Even if the motion is granted, if the motion granted that they're excluded, that would be a specific ruling. If the motion is denied that they're not excluded, as you pointed out earlier, they're still subject to all the foundation requirements, the relevancy requirements, the not hearsay requirements. This ruling does not admit the testimony. All it does is say, I'm not going to exclude it at this point in time. So it's completely different from DeNova. In that case, he said, if he testifies, it's coming in. In this case, he said, I'm not going to exclude it. But that doesn't mean everything else, as you pointed out, has not been what it is that. This motion was not by us to have it admitted, it was by them to exclude it. And that ruling, even without the language that the court points out, doesn't waive all the other obligations to prove. And then those obligations were waived when they put the witness on and elicited direct testimony about his conclusions, his background, and all those things. As a result of that, I think they put themselves in a position, for whatever reason, that they elicited the testimony that they're now complaining about, and I don't think the court, for a variety of reasons, should allow people to introduce evidence and then say, King's X, I don't like that. Especially if the verdict comes in. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson, and both counsel. Excellent job. That's very helpful to the court. This matter will be taken under submission, and we'll have a decision here in a